Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, Bosses Talk Tough with Staff Amid Power Shift by Chip Cutter. And then Ryan Burge and Tony Jones wrote, Are Americans Really Losing Their Religion? We have an article by Steve Magnus, Why All In Is No Recipe for Success. Eric Edelman and Franklin Miller wrote, FEMA Prepares for Disasters Worse Than Hurricanes. And we'll follow that up with an article by Kate Lewis, I Thought I Knew What For Better or Worse Meant, Then My Back Went Out. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, Bosses Talk Tough with Staff Amid Power Shift. Corporate America's long-running war for talent sounds more like a war on the talent these days. Not long ago, bosses routinely praised workers as their most prized asset. So much that had courted new hires before having enough for them to do. Today, with a giant question mark hanging over the economy, executives are pulling no punches and saying employees need to work harder, complain less, and be glad they still have jobs. Work-life balance is your problem. Emma Grede, co-founder of the shapewear company Skims and CEO of clothing label Good America, said recently, after recently cutting more than 1,000 jobs, Starbucks CEO Brian Nickel said remaining corporate staff needed to step it up and own whether or not this place grows. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, in a profanity-laced internal meeting, told employees lamenting a return-to-work mandate that he didn't care. I've had it with this kind of stuff, he said. I've been working 7 days a week since COVID, and I come in, and where is everybody else? The shift in tone marks a shift in power now that companies are shrinking their white-collar staff. With jobs harder to find, many workers are seeing perks disappear and their grievances ignored. The latest episode happened at a contentious all-hands at Uber last month. The company had just changed the requirements to get a month-long paid sabbatical to 8 years of working at the ride-hail giant from 5 years. A decision to require people to work at least 3 instead of 2 days in the office also drew complaints. CEO Dara Karawashani suggested those unhappy with the changes deal with it. We recognize some of these changes are going to be unpopular, he said in comments originally reported by CNBC. This is a risk we decided to take. How much more license do bosses have to talk tough to staff? Take the outrage in 2023 when the head of furniture company MillerKnoll told staffers worried about bonuses to leave Pity City. That comment, made in a video call, immediately went viral, sparking days of headlines and worker backlash. CEO Andy Owen quickly apologized and said her comments were insensitive. After the Uber town hall, on the other hand, Chief People Officer Nikki Kumanath-Worthy issued a memo saying that the company would speak with some staff for being disrespectful in voicing their displeasure. Workers like Dominic Dunselman, who recently worked for a technology services firm, can sense the new power dynamic. As he applies for new tech jobs, the 47-year-old has noticed that many companies now want applicants to do so many tasks, a position is essentially 3 jobs in one. They want it all, he said. In his job search, he tries to suss out the culture of a company because he has noticed the tough talk language from CEOs and finds it worrisome. All you're doing is putting fear in people. You're not going to get good results from that, said Donaldson, who lives near Lexington, Kentucky. Behind CEO's more brusque tone lies a disconnect between employees and executives, said Michael McCutcheon, an adjunct professor in applied psychology at New York University and an executive coach. Some employees are still operating like it is 2021, when they could name their demands because of labor shortages and a surge in worker resignation, she said. Now bosses face a global trade war and sinking consumer confidence and feel they must ask more of employees to survive. This is a matter of pragmatism, McCutcheon said. President Trump and Elon Musk have helped set the more aggressive tone in their bid to slash the federal workforce. Everybody's replaceable, as Trump put it shortly after his inauguration. Advances in generative AI also play a role. Shopify CEO Toby Lucky recently told employees that the e-commerce company will not make new hires unless managers can prove AI is not capable of doing the job. Other business leaders are wanting their staff to adapt more AI or else. Employees will someday have their moment in the sun again, said Charles A. O'Reilly, a professor of management at Stanford. When the market turns around and job opportunities are plentiful, then CEOs will start to talk more about how important employees are, and employees will take advantage of it, he said. For now, though, some executives say fewer, not more corporate staff will help them run more efficiently. Recently, Match Group, which runs dating apps Hinge and Tinder, became the latest company to say it planned to thin its managerial ranks in sweeping layoffs. About one in five managers will be cut, and Match CEO Spencer Rascoff told investors the company is stepping up efforts to cut costs and rewire the organization to focus on its products. We lit a fire under the team here, Rascoff said. And now, are Americans really losing their religion? The biggest story in American religion is the dramatic rise of the nuns, people who say they are atheist, agnostic, or have no particular religious faith. The nuns are currently at an all-time high of about 30% of the population, or Americans born since 1996, the figure is around 45%. Yet it's striking how little is known about this group. For several decades, social science has been content to lump all 100 million non-religious Americans into a single category. That is finally starting to change. Back in 2024, we conducted the largest ever survey of nuns with 12,000 participants. The results challenged the assumption of many religious thinkers that every human being has a deep yearning for God. In fact, one-third of non-religious people fall into a category we call the duns, because they are finished with religion altogether and want nothing to do with it. Not only do people in this group never attend organized religious services, 88% say they never pray at all. Just 6% of the duns agree with the statement, "When I die, I will be reunited with loved ones," while 77% believe that when they die, my existence ends. For the duns, the absence of God and spirituality does not seem to negatively affect their mental health or well-being in any way. The share of duns who agreed with the statement, "I feel I do not have much to be proud of," was 20%, statistically the same as among Protestants or Catholics. Things are different in another group representing about 10% of non-religious Americans. We call them the zealous nuns, because they are evangelical about their unbelief. More than three quarters of this group tried to persuade someone to abandon their faith during the prior year. Unlike the Duns, the Zealots nuns seem to have more struggles with mental health and well-being. They were 13 points more likely than Christians to say, "I feel that my life is not very useful." But the majority of non-religious, non-Americans have a more complicated attitude towards spirituality. We found that 21% are what we call nuns in name only. Over half of this group say they pray daily, and a third attends some kind of religious service at least once a year. And 66% say they feel drawn towards spirituality, but are much more resistant to the idea of organized religion. There are constant headlines about the rise of anxiety, isolation, and mental illness in the United States, and some commentators point to the decline of religion as a cause. Our research does not exactly confirm that idea. While an increase in religious participation may lead to some positive outcomes, a significant number of people are good without God. At the same time, the majority of non-religious Americans do yearn for some kind of connection with a higher power. This suggests that a religious revival is certainly possible in the United States, so long as the nuns aren't seen as a problem to be solved, but a group that needs to be understood better. And now, why all in is no recipe for success. A single-minded, relentless drive. That's what it takes to be successful. Be all in. Burn the boats behind us. That message is ingrained in our society, from self-help books and Nike advertisements to social media influencers, all telling us that we need to commit more and strive harder. The world continually sends the signal to narrowly define your goals and objectives and chase them with an obsessive zeal. For much of my life, I believed in this credo. I was a phenom of an athlete, becoming the fastest high school miler in the country my senior year, when I ran a 4-minute, 1-second mile. In the midst of my ascent, writing in my high school running log, I left a comment with the typical self-dramatizing flair of a teenager. I don't go out, I don't party, I don't live the life of a normal teen. Is this even living? Why do it? I want to be the best. I will not settle for mediocrity. I will take my body through hell, testing its limits. Teenage Steve was certainly obsessive, and he was convinced that going all in was the key to success. He was mostly wrong. When my progress as a runner stalled, I spent time with a renowned sports psychologist. He told me a story about a world-class runner who had become stuck while struggling to make the transition from success in high school and college to Olympic-level performance. The psychologist asked me, "Do you want to know what's helped her break through?" I leaned forward, prepared to hear what surely was the secret to making the Olympics. He looked me in the eyes and replied, "Knitting." She had taken up knitting to relax and take her mind off running. I was too young and stubborn to heed the advice. I doubled down and never ran faster than my high school record or broke a 4-minute mile. In the years since, working as a coach with elite performers, including Olympic medalist runners, I kept noticing that their single-minded focus, their supposed superpower, was getting in their way. Their focus on achieving specific goals had become an obstacle, a constant disabling signal that they were not measuring up. The relentless approach was backfiring. Research backs this up. According to a 15-year survey of more than 5,000 would-be entrepreneurs, those who kept their day jobs instead of focusing only on their own project were 33% less likely to fail. Researchers at Michigan State University looked at over 100 years of Nobel Prize-winning scientists and found that they were more likely than their less accomplished peers to have creative interests outside of their research. The prize winners were 22 times more likely to perform, sing or act as a hobby, 12 times more likely to pursue creative writing, and about 7 times more likely to participate in a craft like sculpting, painting, or glassblowing. As for athletes, those who specialize early in one sport tend to be worse off over the long haul than their compatriots who dabbled in other activities and specialized later. A 2021 meta-analysis evaluating 6,000 athletes found that those who made it to world-class competition tended to have more multi-sport practice, started their primary sport later, accumulated less practice time, and progressed a bit more slowly. To be sure, the more we care and the more our job of pursuit feels like a part of who we are, the harder we'll work. That's helpful to a certain point. Research looking at everything from getting people to vote to taking care of the environment to eating healthier tells us that when we identify closely with something, we're more likely to make sure our actions and identity align. But such narrowing comes with a downside. As we shed other parts of ourselves and that one activity becomes an even bigger presence, fear starts to take over. We don't just want to succeed, we have to. We're not just playing a game, it's ourself on the line. Fear of failure rises and moves from I failed to I am a failure. Studies by Patrick Godot and colleagues at the University of Ottawa found that striving with a hyper-results-oriented approach leads to less experimentation and a propensity to stick to the status quo and avoid challenges. In sports, such striving is at the heart of choking and underperformance. Athletes with a singular identity based on their sport more often experience what's called threat stress response. When fear of failure dominates, athletes produce more of the stress hormone cortisol and less testosterone, a mixture that nudges us toward avoidance and protection. When we feel challenged but not threatened, it's the opposite effect. More testosterone, less cortisol. When outcomes are all that matters and winning or losing becomes self-defining, our default response is not to become a warrior, to retreat. The secret is to go in a different direction. When the world screams to go narrow, elite performers learn to go broad. The lesson that professional mountain biker Kate Courtney had to learn. As she told me, my superpower is being able to grind. And it worked for a while. But after initial success in the prime of her athletic career at the age of 25, she felt worn out and her performance was going backward. Courtney did not do what most athletes do in those moments, double down and work harder. She eased up. When you have a more well-rounded life, it doesn't take away, it doesn't distract you as an athlete, she said. It makes you stronger and better and able to have a clear head when you get the opportunity to line up. I bring who I am to the bike, but the bike does not make me who I am. Now 29, Courtney is currently ranked 9th in the world. It's not that knitting is special any more than the various hobbies that the Nobel-winning scientists took up. But any activities or perspectives that give complexity to our self-image help send a message to our brain that the thing in front of us is important, but it's not all that matters. Other performers I surveyed spoke of simply putting the experience above the outcome. As one world-class runner put it, I have to know when to throw the watch away. An entrepreneur relayed to me, somewhere along the way, we numb ourselves to the experience in the name of chasing metrics. It's better, he said, to remember what the motivation was for the enterprise in the first place. It's the feeling, the excitement, curiosity, just this energy that makes us feel alive. And now FEMA prepares for disasters worse than hurricanes. The Trump administration is hell-bent on shrinking the federal government, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency is on the chopping block. How Washington delivers disaster relief to the states could certainly be improved. But FEMA does more than write checks after hurricanes hit. Plays a vital role in coordinating the continuity of the federal government and its operations in the event of a nationwide emergency. President Trump should consider the consequences for national security before rushing ahead with a plan to close FEMA. At the height of the Cold War, how to ensure that senior United States government leadership could function during and after a nuclear attack was a topic of intense debate. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara instigated several programs to support trans-attack survivability of senior leadership after the Cuban Missile Crisis. As the nation got bogged down in Vietnam, senior leaders' attention shifted despite warnings from government panels investigating the problem. One panel found responsibility for communications, command, and continuity of government hopelessly fragmented and raised questions about the United States government's ability to respond to a nuclear attack. Senior Carter administration officials, such as National Security Advisor Brzezinski and his military aide, Colonel William Odom, raised concerns about the lack of adequate procedures, capabilities, and facilities to ensure the survivability of the National Command Authority in the event of a national emergency. Their efforts produced several presidential directives that set out, for the first time, a national policy on telecommunications, calling it a necessary component of our deterrent posture for defense. A separate directive, PD 58, sought to ensure that a president or duly authorized successors could carry out the key functions of governance in a catastrophe. Brzezinski and Odom understood that programs to ensure continuity of government operations had languished because they were tucked away in disparate parts of the federal bureaucracy, including those tasked with disaster relief. The programs had no natural political constituency because spending lots of federal dollars for something that everyone hoped would never happen was not a vote winner. Back in 1979, President Carter created FEMA and assigned it responsibility for post-catastrophe government operations. It was Odom's idea that local demand for funding could drive a project of importance to national security. That system remains largely in place to this day. The 9/11 attacks were an effort by terrorists to decapitate the United States government. In 2007, the Bush administration established a comprehensive national policy on the continuity of federal government structures and operations. Executive Directive 51 specified that the president's Homeland Security Advisor, currently Stephen Miller, serves as National Continuity Coordinator to synchronize the development and implementation of federal continuity policy. The Homeland Security Secretary was given responsibility for coordinating with state and local governments, as well as private sector owners of critical infrastructure. FEMA has been the instrument for the Homeland Security Department to discharge these responsibilities. It provides guidance, funding, and technical assistance to government and the private sector. It also runs programs for training, testing, and exercising continuity of government operations. In many ways, today's challenges are more daunting than they were during the Cold War and the War on Terror. But both Russia and China are developing military capabilities to attack critical United States infrastructure and potentially decapitate the United States leadership structure. Terrorism remains a real threat, as does a catastrophic cyber attack. Natural disasters don't happen only in the movies. The Trump administration should be assuring the American people that their federal government will survive and continue to function no matter what happens. Anything that undermines public confidence in that idea is an unnecessary gift to America's enemies. Now, I thought I knew what for better or worse meant. Then my back went out. Year 2020 was an uncertain time. COVID-19 was ravaging the globe, and I was scrambling to entertain a kindergartner whose school year had been cut short and a toddler who did not understand why we could not go outside. My husband worked long days at the Pentagon, and as the death toll rose, my thoughts often swerved into dark places. How much worse will things get? The answer came too soon. One Saturday, after YouTube yoga in the living room, pain splintered my spine. I lay down to give my back a rest and found I could not get back up. "Hold on to me," my husband said. "I can do it," I insisted, blinking back tears. I wasn't used to leaning on anyone, not even him. He was a military pilot, often on missions during our children's youngest years, including 11 days after our daughter's birth. I was used to figuring out how to handle things alone. I was proud that I could. I sat up slowly, then tried to stand, but the pain was agonizing. I gripped my husband's arm so tightly, I left white stripes on his skin. 9 years earlier, we stood before our loved ones and vowed to keep standing by each other, for better or worse. The oar held a lot of weight for me then, as though we had a choice between the two, as though we might just need to work harder through the one to earn back the other. Like many young couples, we've been filled with hope and confidence, a certainty that we could shape the world and our lives within it any way we wished. We'd braced for the worst too. We prepared for my husband's first deployment by signing our wills and a stack of documents outlining what should be done in case of his death, who I'd want to deliver the news. Or worse, was an idea I thought I understood. During his deployments, every doorbell ring held the grim possibility of someone bearing devastating news. But what did "or worse" mean now in this upended world of unknowns? I was the one who held things together in our family. What would happen if I fell apart? After urgent x-rays and MRIs, the answer from my doctors was that my lower discs were simply gone. With degenerative disc disease, my vertebrae crunched up against each other, bone on bone. To stave off surgery, my doctor prescribed strong steroids and physical therapy when I was well enough. Meanwhile, I was supposed to get plenty of rest and stay mostly in bed, a prescription that seemed at once simple and impossible, at least at the time. The pandemic meant we had to manage on our own. Before he left for work, my husband woke early to make big breakfast and set out peanut butter sandwiches for lunch. He told our kids to watch movies downstairs, but the allure of nonstop Netflix quickly wore thin. What my kids really wanted was me. I tried to fill the seemingly endless hours until my husband came back home. Tickle fights were out, playing hospital, an obvious choice, was in. So with fashion show, which involved the kids digging through my closet for wide-brimmed sun hats and leather boots that stretched to their hips. Weeks into our new routine, the pain was still excruciating, but we continued to find new ways to care for each other. My husband set a carafe of coffee on my nightstand each morning so I could refill my mug from bed. My daughter brushed my hair as I lay still and stroked her small hands across my face. My son brought me cups of water throughout the day, his steps small and slow, so nothing splashed over the sides. I started to feel a semblance of hope. Life never turns out the way we think it will. 5 years later, my back still hurts, and I cannot move the way I used to. My husband's current military job is still demanding, though less dangerous, and he still brings me coffee in bed. Our children are older and back in school, and my daughter still brushes my hair, weaving her fingers through the strands. I thought, for better or worse, was a binary that meant triumphing over the bad, returning life to the better. But it turns out it's not either or, all or nothing. It's both, and the or worse can be a regular part of reality rather than a looming threat. But if you're lucky, it can exist alongside the joys. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.